hello. First, thank you for having me. And as John said, I'm going to talk about Gleason-type theorems. So I'm going to talk about some projects that I've been doing with my supervisor, Stefan Weigert, at the University of York. So I'm actually going to talk about the advertised project, which is a Gleason-type theorem for qubits from mixtures of projective measurements. And I'm also going to talk about a project that's still sort of in preparation, which is called only general probabilistic theories satisfying the no-restriction hypothesis admit a Gleason-type theorem. So before I can get into either of these topics, I'll give you a brief intro on Gleason's theorem and Gleason-type theorems, because I'm not sure what everyone knows. So Gleason's theorem was a mathematical result, which has at least two applications in quantum theory. And the one that we're going to be concerned with today is the one that motivated him to prove the result in the first place. And the basic idea is that it shows that if we postulate projective measurements, as we would normally do in quantum theory, or as we could do in quantum theory, then Gleason's theorem shows that states have to take the form of density operators, and the probability of observing a certain measurement outcome is given by the Born rule. So to be more precise, what I mean by projective measurements is, so if we measure an observable, which is represented by a self-adjoint operator, and then if this is the collection of projections which are associated with that observable, then a state can be represented by a density operator rho, and then the Born rule is like the trace rule, where you take the product of the relevant projector and the density operator and then the trace of those to give you the probability. So this is a more precise version of that. So our first postulate would be postulate H, that a quantum system can be associated with a separable Hilbert space. And then we give the postulate M, that measurements are associated with collections of projections like this, which sum to the identity. And then each projection corresponds to a possible outcome of that measurement. So then in kind of standard postulations of quantum theory, we'd then go on to say that states have to be represented by density operators and not give any motivation for that postulate. But instead of that, we're going to think about what a natural definition for a state could be, given that we've made these two postulates already. So if we imagine that we have two sources of a quantum system, and then if we perform every possible measurement that we can imagine on the system from the first source or on the system from the second source, we would get exactly the same statistics from those measurements, then there is no way that we can distinguish those two states, because we've done like every possible measurement we could think of. Therefore, we're going to consider those two states as equivalent. So what this would mean is that a state is given by a map F from the space of outcomes of our measurements, which is the projection lattice, to probabilities. So that's saying that states correspond to probability assignments on our outcomes, which is like the main thing you need to understand for the rest of the talk. So try and think about that. And we would also want that, because we consider a collection of projections that sum to the identity to be a complete measurement, then we want the probabilities to sum to one that we assign to these projections. Yeah.
What's the technical point? When you say projections, you mean self-adjoint projections?
Yeah, self-adjoint projections. Projections onto the closed subspaces of your Hilbert space, yeah. Sorry. I was trying to keep it short.
Are you asking that F be a homomorphism on that projection lattice? I'm wondering, like, the constraint that
so it's just
F of pi 1 plus pi 2 should equal F of pi 1 plus F of pi 2.
No, we don't assume that.
You haven't assumed that?
No, but you can get that from this condition, in that If you kind of cross-grain two of them together, that will also be a collection which sums to the identity, and that would also be equal to one, and then you can minus off the other ones, and then you'd get the additive property. So it turns out to be an equivalent.
So for all identity into projectors,
yeah.
You assume that F defines a two-valued.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
So this was our setup, and then what Gleason's theorem shows is that if H is a separable Hilbert space with dimension greater than or equal to 3, which we'll come back to in a minute, then any one of these functions that we've just considered, so probability assignments on our projectors that sum to 1 for collections of projectors that sum to the identity, any one of these maps can be represented as the trace of the projector, the product of the projector and a density operator, and then the trace of that thing. So in other words, every one of these maps has a corresponding density operator. So you could represent the map by the density operator. So with what we were saying before, that means that our states have to be represented by density operators. So then the thing I just mentioned, that the dimension of the Hilbert space has to be greater than or equal to 3, is a small problem. And you can see why it's a problem. If you think about, so in dimension 2, all these projections can be represented on the surface of the block sphere. And then the only collections which sum to the identity are pairs of antipodal points. So then our probability assignment would just be, you have to assign P and 1 minus P to pairs of opposite points. So there's a lot of ways that you can do that that don't take the form of a density operator. So for example, to the entire like top hemisphere, you could assign 1, and to the bottom hemisphere, 0. Then all the pairs would sum to 1. But there's no density operator that does that, right? So the these conditions are like simply not enough to necessitate the trace rule that we had before. So this is pretty sad, but unfortunately, but fortunately, we have a solution to that. Generalized measurements come to the rescue. So these were our postulates that we had before, and now we're going to replace our measurement postulate, which was for like PVMs or projective measurements, with a generalized measurement postulate, which would be like POVMs, or what I'm going to annoyingly call POMs for the rest of the talk. So now measurements can be represented by collections of effects, which would be like E1, E2, so on, which sum to the identity, where each effect corresponds to the outcome of a measurement. So these would be what people call POM elements a lot of the time. So they're just non-negative operators between 0 and the identity. So now we can apply like the same logic that we did before, and our states have to be maps now on the space E of H of effects to probabilities, and then these probabilities need to sum to 1 for any collection of effects which represents a measurement in our theory.
You're not assuming
4 and 12,
right?
No. That's so what we want to get out. So that's like just part of our postulate. Yeah. So that's something that you postulate, right? Is that yeah? So like the identity kind of represents doing nothing.
E of H here is now not a lattice but a positive cone.
Yes. Yeah, well, so it's like the intersection of two cones, right? Yeah. So then in this scenario, Paul Bush proved a nice result, which now applies for any quantum system. So we only need the dimension to be greater than or equal to 2. So now any of these maps which represent our states, probability assignments that sum to 1, any of those maps admits an expression in terms of a density operator in the way that we wanted it to. So that's what's already known, yeah. So do you know, are you familiar with POVMs?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the elements of your POVM are just the effects, yeah. So now we can ask our question, which we answer with our first result, which is there a smaller set of POVMs or measurements which would have this property? So where if we look at the probability assignments on just a restricted set of POVMs, we get the same, we get the Born rule out again, is the question. So in the result we just looked at, the set of POVMs we consider is all POVMs. But when we want to say, can we look at a smaller set? And the answer to this question is yes. And to show you why, I need to first tell you what projective simulable measurements are. So we'll start with an example. So if we imagine we have some experimental setup which has like a Stern-Gerlach apparatus, and with probability 1/2, it measures in the sigma z eigenbasis, and with probability 1/2, it measures in some other basis. So then if we call like this outcome 0 and also this outcome 0, so if this one was measured, this is outcome 0. If this one was measured, this is outcome 0. Then if we try and calculate the probability of observing outcome 0 for the whole experiment, we would get that with probability 1/2, we did this measurement, and then the probability of getting 0 is given by this expression, so the trace of this 0 projector with our density operator. And then also with probability 1/2, we would get the 0 outcome in this experiment given by, and the probability given by this expression. So then we can combine these two things together. And now we have the trace of this operator with our density operator. So, and this operator is an effect. So then if we do the same thing for the outcome 1, we would get this operator here. So then we've essentially implemented this POVM here. Because the probability of observing outcome 0 is given by the trace of rho with this thing, and the probability of observing outcome 1 is given by the trace of rho with this thing. So then if we can, so if we can do a procedure like this to simulate a POVM where we mix together projective measurements, then we say that that POVM is projective simulable. And to give you an idea of what those look like, so this is a diagram for dimension 2. So if this square represents, or rectangle, represents all POMs, then we've got the projective measurements in the middle here is PVMs. And then because we're in dimension 2, 2POM is going to be the POVMs which have at most 2 outcomes. So then projective measurements are contained within there because they all just have at most 2 outcomes. And then PSM is a space of projective simulable measurements. And this includes all the 2 outcome POVMs, but not necessarily not all the 3 outcome ones, and therefore not all POVMs. So it's like a strict subset of all POVMs is PSM. And that's, yeah, projective simulable measurements. So then this brings us to the result that we've proved. So now we look at a finite dimensional Hilbert space, and then we consider a probability assignment on the space of effects such that the probabilities sum to 1 for any collection of effects which constitutes a projective simulable POVM. So this is a weaker condition than the one from Paul's result, where this had to hold for all POVMs, but now it only has to hold for projective simulable ones. And then we find, yeah, that these maps have to have the form that we want them to have, so it can be expressed in terms of a density operator. So then, something I wanted to say. Oh yeah, so it's important to note that in no way, nowhere do we include the assumption that the projective simulable measurements can be made by mixtures of the projections, right? We just assume that measurements which can be represented by these objects exist, and we don't include any of the structure about, you know, the probabilities should match up when you mix these two things. So we kind of drop the interpretation of these POVMs being mixtures of projective measurements. So we don't require that the probability of we don't require that. So in this example, we don't put in the requirement that this should occur with a probability which is the mixture of these two probabilities.
I didn't quite see what you were pointing at.
That.
With your finger, maybe.
So we don't say that this thing should necessarily occur with the half and half mixture of the probabilities with which these two outcomes occur.
But then that comes out of your theorem.
And it comes out as a consequence of the theorem, but isn't put in as an assumption. So we don't use the simulability like structure. We just assume that these things can be considered as measurements. And they might be not related to the things that we've actually generated them from. They might be completely unrelated to those.
So the projective simulable measurements, in a sense, they're just saying they're kind of the convex hull of the PVMs, but you're not using the kind of convexity. You're not interpreting those elements as
being So we're just saying it's a set and we're not using its structure. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it only applies to measurements in that set, but measurements in that set include all of the effects that are in the whole set. So any effect appears in a projective simulable measurement.
All effects appear in the PSM.
Yeah.
So
then. Yeah. So then if you kind of extrapolate that there are more measurements that aren't necessarily in here, but they have to occur with the, then this frame function, this function also has to be, okay. So normally I don't think that proofs should go in talks, but this one's really easy, and it only has two steps, and it's kind of relevant for later, so indulge me slightly. So the first step of our proof is that any two outcome POM is projective simulable. So this is for a generic effect E, and then we get the identity minus E, so that is projective simulable. And also, any POVM of this form is projective simulable. So this is like a half E, and then I minus E for any effect E. So then if we apply our probability rule to these two things, we get that F of E plus F of I minus E has to equal 1. And also F of E over 2 plus F of E over 2 plus F of I minus E has to be equal to 1. So then we can cancel this F of I minus E on both sides, and you find that you can take out a factor of a half from this probability assignment function whenever you want to. So that is step 1. And then step 2, we have two more types of measurement that are always projective simulable. So this is for any pair of effects E and E prime that sum to another effect. So then a measurement of this form is also projective simulable, and a measurement of this form. So then again, if we apply our rule for the probabilities having to sum to 1 on these two measurements, you get that. So the probability assigned to this term has to be equal to the sum of the probabilities assigned to these two terms, because the third term is the same. And then we can use the thing that we found here, that we can take out a factor of 2. So we can take out this factor of 2. And we just find that our function f has to be additive on any pair of effects which sum to another effect, which is actually the same condition as goes into Paul's result, just rephrased slightly. So what we've shown is that any probability assignment which respects the projective simulable measurements in fact respects all POVMs, and therefore you can use Paul's result to show that it has to be of the density operator form.
Are you using the structure that these functions are non-negative, like e belongs to some corner dog?
So in this argument, we haven't actually used that, but in the proof of Paul's result, then yeah, that is used. Yeah, like the actual form of the effects is used.
Is that true? Like these don't even have to be effects, they just have to have kind of linear structure?
But to then go on to, so then we need to use the existing result after this.
Okay.
To get out the form, so then we would need the actual structure, yeah. So how can we apply this result? So there are some different ways in which we could apply it, but here is one example. So if we postulate the two things that we did in the original Gleason scenario, which we know are insufficient to regain the density operator formalism that we want, but then we can add in a third postulate, which I'll call CM, which is classical mixture. So if we add in this postulate, which says that if we do a classical mixture of this projective measurement and this projective measurement with probabilities p and 1 minus p, and then we say that this must be represented in this form, so you just mix the first two terms and then mix the second two terms. So if we add that in as a postulate as to how to represent classical mixtures of projections, then these three postulates together along with our theorem is enough to give you back the density operator formalism. So then the next question is, does there exist an even smaller set of measurements from which we can derive the density operator formalism? So is this set of PSM, of projective simulable POMs, the smallest possible one from which we can prove a Gleason type theorem? And the answer to that is no. And this is the reason that I showed you the proof. So you can see that the only measurements we made use of in the proof are this one here, which is a generic two-outcome POM, this one here, which is a three-outcome one of a special form, this one, which actually has two outcomes as well. So we've already covered that with our first one, so we'll ignore that. And then another three-outcome one of a certain form. So then if we actually consider the set which just has those three types of POMs in, then we know that that is also sufficient to give us a Gleason type theorem. So that's just what this says, and this set would be here. So we called it PSM prime. So it's included in the set of POVMs with at most three outcomes because they have at most three outcomes, but it's not all of them. And then we can try and go again. Is there an even smaller set from which you can prove a Gleason type theorem? And the answer is we don't know yet, but we would like to know. So that's something for the future. So I'll just give a summary of like the first part of the talk. So what we've shown is that projective simulable measurements are sufficient to necessitate the density operator and Born rule formalism. And we've identified an additional postulate that you can add to the setting of Gleason's original theorem so that it extends to dimension 2. And this postulate is about how to represent classical mixtures of projective measurements. And we've identified the smallest existing set of POVMs which yield a Gleason type theorem, because the existing ones was either the set of all POVMs or someone noticed that the set of all three outcome ones was actually sufficient as well. But ours is strictly smaller than that. And as I mentioned, questions we would like to answer in the future, is PSM prime minimal in this sense? Or would be, is there some subset of it which we can also get a Gleason type theorem from? And if there is there anything special about that set? Is it, yeah, and what would it mean? And we'd also like to generalize the result to infinite dimensions, but that needs a bit of work on how to represent projective simulability in infinite dimensions first. So that's the summary of the first part. So I guess I'll move on to the second part. And we can do questions at the end like normal. So the second half of the talk is to answer the question, if nature had presented us with a different theory to quantum theory or classical theory, would we still be able to derive a Gleason type theorem? And so we're going to answer this question in the setting of general probabilistic theories. So I'll give a brief description of what those are in case you don't know. So general probabilistic theories are a broad range of theories which include quantum theory and classical theory as specific examples, but also have a lot of other theories that we don't know to exist in nature included within the framework, but that are useful to compare the theories that we know to exist with. So the framework for constructing these theories is derived in an operational way, and I won't mention all of the motivations for these, all of these operational motivations. I'll just tell you what the outcomes of them are. So like the things that the framework says our theory has to satisfy. So the first one is that the state space of our theory has to be a convex subset of a real vector space. And I'm going to focus on finite dimensions, so that will always be equivalent to r to the d. Here I've gone with r to the d plus 1, and the plus 1 is just some normalization dimension, I guess. So that's not really important. So for example, our state space could be this nice circle here, or it could be any polygon, or something which has like straight edges and curved edges in places, whatever you want. And then we have the effect space of the theory, which is the space of all objects which correspond to outcomes of measurements. And this is derived by considering all linear functionals on this vector space, which would give you a probability between 0 and 1 for every state in the state space. And it's a theorem in linear algebra that any linear function like that linear functional can be represented just as another vector in the same space, and then the function is given by the dot product with that vector. So the effect space for our nice circle would look like this. It would be a cone. And the point at the top of this cone is called the unit effect, and it gives you probability 1 for any state. And the point at the bottom is the zero effect, and it gives you probability 0 for any effect, for any state. And then there is this set of extremal effects in the middle, which are also in a circle. So another example of a GPT would be like a qubit, in which case your state space would be the block ball. And then your effect space would look like a 4D version of this. So it would be the convex hull of the identity 0 and the block ball, so in four dimensions. Is there anything else I need to say? So originally, in a lot of the derivations of this framework, the effect space was taken to be this full space. So that like every single vector which would give a probability between 0 and 1 for every state. But later this has been taken out of the framework in general, and it's referred to as the no restriction hypothesis. So if your model satisfies the no restriction hypothesis, then your effect space is given by exactly all of those vectors. So all the vectors that give a probability between 0 and 1 for all your states. And quantum theory and classical theories are examples of theories that satisfy the no restriction hypothesis. But it's been pointed out that there's no particular reason why that would need to hold. So then the framework was expanded to account for theories that don't, that violate the no restriction hypothesis, so they have like a restricted effect space. So in these ones, your effect space E has to be some subset of this set, but it still needs to include zero and the unit effect. And also for every effect, there has to be U minus that effect, which is the same as saying for any outcome, there has to be a kind of that outcome didn't occur option. So a yes or no sort of thing. So in our example that we had before, if you can see, this was the cone effect space and an example of a restricted effect space. We could just take the square that's inside here and then the convex hull of that with zero and the unit effect. So yeah, that's the no restriction hypothesis. And then our theorem is that, so if we let S and E be the state and effect spaces of a GPT, then we have F is a probability assignment on the effects E, such that the probabilities sum to one for any collection of effects which sum to the unit effect. Then this map necessarily a mixed expression as a dot product, as the dot product with some vector W in the state space. But this only holds if the GPT that we started with satisfies the no restriction hypothesis. So if your effect space was kind of generated from your state space as all the possible effects that you could have, then this Gleason type theorem holds. But if that is not true, and if you've restricted your effect space, then this condition is insufficient to specify that your states have to be of the form of the states in the state space.
Are you just showing that the effect space is closed as well?
Yeah. Yeah, sorry. Probably should have put that in. Yeah. Okay, so some comments on the theorem.
So if you relax the no restriction hypothesis, then the only thing that would change in the theorem is it wouldn't be for some state W, it would be for some vector in the linear span.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, that's the only thing that changes. Yeah. We'll sort of see that that happens in the next slide as well. So the first comment is that this theorem reduces to Bush's Gleason type theorem if the state and effect spaces you start with at the beginning are like quantum state and effect spaces, then this is the same result. And also, yeah, as we were just saying, it's quite easy to see what happens for what goes wrong with the restricted effect spaces. So if this was our restricted effect space here, then we actually get that these maps F would correspond to vectors in this like larger square, which was larger than our state space to begin with. So that kind of fits with this idea of like the duality between your state and effect spaces. So this effect, the dual of this effect space is this square, and that's why we ended up getting back to this with our map rather than getting back to the circle. Okay. It's similar to the proof of Bush's result. Yeah, it's very similar. Yeah. No, it doesn't become nonlinear. Yeah, it's still linear. Yeah, it is. It's just that you get like a superset of your original state space. So in the framework, if you started with your state space and generated some effect space, but then restricted it, then you get back to a bigger state space via this map.
Okay. So there's a bigger set of objects in the system.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they're still like linear. Yeah. Okay.
You could can imagine linearity breaking down, at least this is a little more comment for me. So in if you work with objects which are in quantum theory, you work with wave functions instead of density operators. And the real numbers that specify the wave function enter as the square into the formula.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I guess if you had a like weaker condition, you could end up with some nonlinear maps. But it turns out that this condition is strong enough to specify linearity. But like in the Gleason case, the Gleason's original case in two dimensions, there it's not strong enough to specify linearity. So there you can have nonlinear maps, if that helps. So, yeah, then to summarize this section, we've got the GPTs, which satisfy the no restriction hypothesis, yield a Gleason type theorem, but restricted GPTs do not. So then something you could do with this result is that if you required that your theory has to admit a Gleason type theorem, then you would rule out all the theorems which violate the no restriction hypothesis. And Berlin showed that any GPT which produces the set of almost quantum correlations must violate the no restriction hypothesis. So you could combine our results to show that any GPT which produces a set of almost quantum correlations cannot yield a Gleason type theorem. And something that we would like to do in the future is to think about what motivation you could have for requiring the existence of a Gleason type theorem or for requiring the no restriction hypothesis, like whether there are any kind of more natural motivations for putting those things in as a requirement. So that's the end of my talk. Thanks for listening.
Mm-hmm. Is the statement that if it goes beyond ordinary quantum mechanics, in a trivial way, then it must violate it? Is that the statement?
So there's this set of correlations known as almost quantum correlations, which are a superset of quantum correlations. Yeah, yeah.
You're saying it must produce.
So if your GPT produces exactly that set, then it must be a GPT that violates.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Could it produce some of that set, which is bigger than the quantum set? But
so in between the two sets?
Yeah.
I don't know about that. Does anyone in the audience know?
Well, I mean, basically the way that we showed that we solved is by finding some examples of correlations in the almost quantum setup where if you allowed for every possible effect, then by taking extensions of like many parts in your scenario, you would be able to go outside the set. So somehow it wouldn't be closed under its own operation. So as long as you have a theory that somehow allows you to access the probabilities that we use in our example, then you might be able to generate a similar counterexample.
Yeah, so then your GPT would give a bigger set than the almost quantum ones.
Yeah,
so then,
so
yeah.
So you can use the tools that we used in the where we proved this result for almost quantum correlations to a smaller set and see if you can find a way to prove that it's not something. But I didn't really have any motivation to go closer to the quantum set. But it could be the case.
And what was this consistency you're talking about? Composing subsystems?
Yes, so basically you can think of, just take your set of correlations and then imagine that there's a GPT that generates them. Then you can just take Alice, Bob, and Charlie and now think of Alice and Bob as just one party and then wire the devices in the labs, like think of them as black boxes, wire them. And this wiring operation that should in principle like not give you anything weird in theory, should be something that you are allowed to do in your lab, allows you to like now combine these effects in a way that they produce something that generates correlations beyond what you can do. So somehow, if you want to think of it not only as correlations, what this result tells you is that you can take effects, wire them together, and generate a vector that is not the effect space of the combined this many party dual space.
I'm not sure I understand why you're acting up, but it's some interaction that you're introducing.
Yeah.
The two parts.
So I have two comments. The first is, I think I would have conceived of a Gleason type theory a little bit differently from the way that you've done it here.
Mm-hmm.
And so, particularly, the slogan for the second half, if you can go back to the slides, or the title of the second half of the talk is.
Right at the beginning.
So you the second half, the conclusion was that only those GPTs which satisfy an hypothesis have a Gleason type theorem. So in the way you've interpreted Gleason type theorem, I agree. But to my mind, the Gleason's theorem, I mean, what it was, it wasn't, I mean, I don't remember exactly what's said in Gleason's paper, but most of the time it gets used, it's not saying, you know, if I consider a function over projectors that satisfy its properties, then for all density operators, trace rho E is a possible assignment of probabilities, or trace rho pi is a possible assignment of probabilities to those projectors, but rather every assignment of probabilities to the projectors is of the form trace rho E for some rho.
Yeah, that's the way around, I think of it. Yeah, so this is saying that every assignment of probabilities is of the form E dot W for some W.
Right. And so then maybe I misunderstood. So I would have thought that if I don't satisfy the restriction hypothesis, this is still true, that there is some W, but not all W give me valid functions. So
all W would give you valid functions, but the set of all W that we get is larger than the state space that we started with.
Right.
So not every map has a corresponding W. So that would be the same as in Gleason's theorem as having maps that don't correspond to density operators. So you've got all the density operators and some more. That would be the same result. So here we've got all the W and some more.
So it's like all the correlation, all the probability assignments would be generated by that dot rule, mm-hmm. But now you wouldn't, if you want to explain every single possible one of them, you need to not just consider
right.
the set of states, but something larger.
Right. Okay, so yeah, I think I understand. So I guess what it says is something like the form of the probability rule will definitely be a dot product with some real value vector, but that real value vector need not exist inside this particular set of states
that we started with, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so you're taking that to be analogous to
then not being a Gleason type theorem.
I guess okay. So I was translating there exists a row such that to there exists a real vector such that.
Yeah.
So,
so if you do that,
there exists a real vector that lies inside the set of states.
Yeah. So if you do that, so like in this example, you then get back to the square state space instead of the circle that you started with. If that makes sense.
Maybe it's something like saying in Gleason's theorem, if you had to allow density operators which had some negative eigenvalue.
Yeah.
Or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So when we're phrasing Rob's thing is, if you use Gleason's theorem and say, you know, states are density operators, it doesn't necessarily mean all density operators correspond to states. You have to.
Yeah, that's usually. Yeah.
The states. So
yeah.
It's kind of, it's just giving you the general form. It's like whatever the states are, they're expressed by this in the product. So it's kind of where you put the no restriction.
To some extent, the hard part of Gleason's theorem, as I see it, is proving that the probability rule is of the form trace some Hermitian operator times your projector pi. And then getting that that Hermitian operator has to be a positive trace one.
Yeah, it's like the easy part. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Plug in pi equal to identity, you get the normalization.
Yeah, so.
You know, the fact that f is positive gives you the fact that it's.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I always think of Gleason's theorem more about, you know, it's getting it into that.
Into the space, not into the.
Inner product.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so in a sense, the GPT does that. It gets it into this, you know, inner product form,
mm-hmm.
which would be analogous to the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product. And so in that sense, GPTs do have.
Yeah, all of them do. Yeah, yeah. But you haven't narrowed down your states with this definition to the states that you wanted to get to.
Correct.
Yeah.
This shows up in the Universal Framework for Non-Locality by Asin and others, where they try to sort of model no signaling correlations with measurements on a operator, which doesn't have to be a density measure because it can have negative eigenvalues.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's positive for all product measurements.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an entanglement witness, as it were.
Yeah.
But they show that in the multipartite scenario, the set of correlations which can be realized with product measurements on entangled witnesses is different from the no signaling set.
Yeah, I think I know this.
Dubbed that as Gleason
correlations.
They may double it to
Gleason
correlations.
Obvious
reason. So maybe I can just summarize it. I guess for my taste, you know, like when I say with the heart of Gleason's theorem, I like to say that there's this amazing generalization of Gleason's theorem, which is completely underappreciated in the foundation of literature, in a little known 2001 paper by the name of Lucy Cardi. which is precisely showing that, you know, every GPT has a probability rule, which is this linear product form.
Yeah.
In my mind, that
I think more assumptions go into that than go into this, though.
Well, it does start with an assumption of convexity.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the assumptions you're making of this additivity and what Paul pushes, I mean, that's just slightly stronger than convexity, because step one of the proof is, if I have this additive function, then I can take an effect and I can think of it as the sum of 1 over n times that effect n times over.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that, you know, f on that e is just n times f of 1 over n.
Yeah,
e.
Yeah, yeah.
And now, therefore, any rational probability, you know, if you give me a convex mixture with rational probabilities, it'll be convex with
mm-hmm.
respect to those rational probabilities. That's like the first step of the proof.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So personally, I'm happy to just start with convexity. It feels like an equivalent starting point. I don't feel like this is that much more general. And so, to my mind, it's starting in about the same place.
In Lucien's paper, do you not start with the dot product, though?
No, that's derived.
So.
Just derived, but using in that in 2001 paper, you have to use convexity. You know,
okay.
You
yeah.
You can just do it by fiat. So in a later paper, I'm sure people make this point. You can just say, well, let's assume the relationship is linear. And then the
yeah, I think that's get, what I'm thinking
yeah,
of.
The other
yeah.
thing you can get into trouble with that is that it may be a very inefficient way of doing things. But then you can show that actually it's perfectly efficient, optimal, if you do have mixtures of that. But if mixtures aren't allowed, it may be inefficient. And evidence of that is that if you restrict yourself to pure states, then you need fewer parameters to describe a pure state than you do to describe the corresponding density.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I haven't appreciated this same point of view. That really, it's not just the span of the states, but the actual particular set of states, and that doesn't come from these linearities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So let me just make my second comment quickly that. I think that I can come up with another class of EOBMs that's smaller than the class you gave
mm-hmm.
to achieve this, and it might be minimal in some sense. So you just start with an informationally complete POBM.
Mm-hmm.
So E1 to ED squared, if D is the dimension.
Mm-hmm.
Allow every effect that's, you know, 1 over N times each of these effects.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so just say allow POBMs that have 1 over N there. And now you can essentially derive convexity, right, in the same way that Bush would, that any probabilistic mixture of the POVM elements in this informationally complete POVM is allowed as a kind of sum of smaller elements. So now I've got something that's convex, like a function that is convex linear on a set of effects that are information complete. So I would guess that would be enough to say that there must be a density operator that appears in the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product.
Maybe. That wouldn't be contained within our set, though, because you need to have d squared outcomes, and we have at most three outcomes.
That's true.
So then in dimension two, you'd have four outcome ones, and yeah. So it would be like it might overlap with our set, and it might be smaller by some measure, yeah. So it's a good idea, yeah.
I suppose you could do it, instead of taking one d squared element POVM that's information complete, you could try to find a collection of them. Like for a qubit, you could find three two-element POVMs that are information complete.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the sub-normalized versions of all those guys.
Yeah, sufficient. So there is a thing about our result in that this gives you a value for every effect because every effect is contained within some projective simulable measurement. But your function would actually probably be defined on a subset, maybe.
Say that again?
So would your this set of measurements that you're considering, would that contain every single effect as a member of one of those measurements? Because I would think not.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But that's like not necessarily something that you might, it's something you might want, but it's something you might not want, right? So like in Gleason's original theorem, our map doesn't apply to any effects apart from the projections, right? So then if we did extend it to the projections and put no other requirements on them, it could take any value it wanted on the effects that aren't projections. So then we'd have the same thing with your set. But if you only want to consider measurements that have effects that are within your set, then that's fine. So like in the Gleason case, you only want to consider projective measurements. So then that's fine.
I think the logic I have in mind, and it might be a mistake, would be something like, if it's convex linear on these things, then I can extend it to something that's linear on these things. But that extension is so that therefore is the function is going to assign values to effects that aren't in the convex hull of the effects I'm considering.
But you'd extend it in a linear way.
Me to the fact that function is going to act like trace row E, so it will assign the probabilities that quantum mechanics.
So it'll act like trace row E on your subset, but it can do whatever it will, unless you put in extra assumptions about how it acts on something that you haven't put a condition on, then it could do whatever it wanted outside, right?
If it works, if with this more minimal set of effects that does not include all effects, you can still derive that the formula has to be trace row E.
Yeah, on those effects.
But if trace row E on those effects.
Then why does it have to be trace row E anyway?
Any linear combination of those effects, which can.
That's like an extra assumption that you're putting in, right? Is that this your rule should accept, should respect, mixing, or not mixing, but taking linear combinations of your effects which go outside the space that you are considering. But that's something that you can do if you want to, right? It's not an unnatural assumption.
No, I don't want to assume that. I'll have to think about it.
I might be not making sense, but.
Somewhere near the beginning, you put a condition, when you were describing this general probabilistic series, you put a condition that if E is in the set, then U minus E is in.
Yeah.
I think there might be reasons to draft that, so I could describe later.
Yeah.
What happens if you draft that?
So the actual reason that it's in is that in the paper where they describe the no restriction hypothesis, what was that? Oh, some people that might be here. You get if you don't have U minus E for every E, then when you compose systems, you get to some sort of contradiction. Yeah. So it's to do with consistency for compositions of systems is the reason that this assumption is in. But what were you thinking of?
Well, take a while. So I'm thinking of a more general class of measurements
that
one can do, which, as other people here will know, I always think like to think in terms of histories and not in terms of states at a moment of time.
Okay.
Because that's the kind of thing that goes better with relativity, and more importantly, it goes much better with quantum gravity or even gauge theories, but especially quantum gravity than this sliced up in time. So there are events, I would call events, I don't know, conflicts with your terminology, but let's say.
Yeah, you can think of the effects as events, right?
Well, I don't want to think of them.
Oh, so you don't want to think of them as events. Oh, okay.
It's events, so maybe I shouldn't call them. There are sets of histories, which we call, this is the stochastic process or probability terminology, an event. You know, they always have a sample space, which would be, in this physics, the history space, and then an event would be a set of histories. And you can try to make a measurement that'll act as a filter for a particular set of histories. But the important thing is that, so that's a particular event, but the important thing is that these events don't have to be defined by some property at some single moment in time. They're what you might call temporally extended events. Those
okay.
are the interesting ones I find.
So, yeah, so then you wouldn't want to put in this condition.
So then it turns out you can design, it's actually done by a Psi student here, what did a project with me. And it turns out that you can design using ancillisms, coupling the ancillisms in certain ways. You can design a kind of measurement or filter, you would probably call it effects, but I don't think it would quite fit in this framework.
Oh, okay.
Now, if it gives a positive result, in a certain sense, says that event happened. But if it gives a negative result, it doesn't imply that the event didn't happen. That's why I'm saying, in some sense,
okay, yeah.
E is in the
same. Yeah, I don't want to have like E and not E. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, right.
So.
Yeah, that's something to think about.
I mean, I would. Probably sounds a bit vague.
yeah, I need to understand the, yeah.
But yes, it's the statement as people have not explored. You're claiming in the framework that they have considered, it's not consistent to objects.
Yeah, yeah.
If you imagine compose.
Yeah, you encounter some problems later on, yeah.
But in this case, it would be consistent. I'm not sure. Easily compose history spaces and so on.
Yeah, so there's probably some difference somewhere in these frameworks, right?
You derive the fact that there's a linear combination of effects is the same probability, which is the corresponding linear combination of probabilities.
In the first half. Yes, I think. So here.
So I thought you had derived that like a sum of effects is the same.
Oh, so we put that in, do you mean this extra postulate? Where like the convex
I guess the bit where you had the proof.
Oh,
yeah, so this
yes.
last
line. Oh, yeah.
Isn't that what Rob needed to complete this argument?
He needed for different effects, not the ones that are in the set. But
yeah, outside the set. So if your function isn't... So here, because of the form of these measurements, this can be any E and any E prime that sum to another effect. So there can be any pair of effects that sum to another effect. But if you've only considered some subset, then this F might not be defined on this sum, right?
So the minimal set that you're imagining will still contain all the effects.
Yeah.
The only sense of
Yeah, fewer collections of those would correspond to measurements, but that's not something you need to do, right? So this could be an idea, right? So you might want to derive the density operator formalism from a subset, which, and then not consider measurements that have effects that are outside of that subset.
Gleason's theorem, for instance, an example of that.
Yeah, so original Gleason's theorem, an example of that. So you don't consider any POVMs in original Gleason's theorem. Right? So then you only look at your map on the projections.
The way the logic of these work, particularly Gleason theorems, that if you have convex linearity, then it's sort of a unique linear extension. And the way I remember the group going something like, if you have this operator is equal to this real combination of these other operators, take all the negative values and move them to the left of the equation. Renormalize both sides so that they look like probability distributions. Now apply your assumption of convex linearity, and you get the assumption of linearity on the original form. So there's a unique linear extension.
Yeah, but just because there is a unique linear extension doesn't mean you should extend. If you are looking to extend your function, doesn't mean you have to extend it that way, right? That's just like a tool of the proof, the fact that that unique linear extension exists.
No, I think you have to extend it that way.
I think you do.
For example, in Lucene's approach, he points out that once you tell me the probability that some state assigns to a fiducial set of effects, which are essentially a basis for the vector space, then you have no choice about how it assigns probabilities to every other effect. So with
an assumption that like your states are kind of mixtures of each other, that's like an assumption that you're putting in.
All those other effects are not merely the convex mixtures of your fiducial effects. They really are other effects which may only be real combinations of your fiducial effects. So I think that's part of the essence of the result, is that by constraining how things look on this fiducial set, I don't merely get how it acts on the convex hull of those, but how it acts on everything. So convex linearity is powerful enough to get you linearity, to get you the inner product form, to get you how the state will act on everything else.
Okay, I don't agree. but maybe... I did, but... I don't think it's going to help to satisfy. So this was my extra slide, but I don't think it will. I think the argument will still be the same.
Okay. I mean, I agree with what I'm saying, but I don't understand. I think there must be a different framework, a different way of thinking about this problem.
Yeah. So.
Think
so.
It feels like we're genuinely disagreeing.
I think you know what I mean, right?
I think so. I mean, I think it's a question of, are you interpreting your, so you've got, a few of your effects to use to your theorem, then you say, okay, I want to know what happened on these other effects, like E plus E dash, which one's my initial set. Am I allowed to, is E plus E dash like just a kind of label, so it's just another element in this set, or am I allowed to interpret it literally with this additive structure?
Yeah.
As soon as you have this, so it kind of, that's how I do it. But yeah, the question, I guess the question is like, is it fair to say that this, you should also have this as more than a label, so have the additive structure on it?
Yeah, so I'd be considering the effects that are outside of the set that you've considered as just random labels that are in no way associated with the effects that are inside, right? Because I'm not putting any condition on them, because I've not said that they form measurements. So they're not even in the domain of my function f.
But we are sort of granting them to get all these theorems that, for instance, the state assigned to an effect is the space of effects are represented by a positive operator in a complex level space. And therefore, it's meaningful to say I want to consider the effect, which is alpha e1 plus beta e2, where alpha and beta are real numbers. So if I can show b that that is also a positive operator, this last identity.
So I think that's the difference in what we're thinking about. So I'm saying that if you just, anything that is outside your set, you don't consider it as a measurement outcome. Because, so the assumptions that we're putting in are just that the effects in our that the measurements in our set are the only measurements, and then the effects that feature in those measurements are the only effects. So I think that's what we're disagreeing on. So you're considering ones that are outside of the set as still to correspond to some outcomes of some measurement, even though, so that would be like an assumption that you're putting in, sort of.
So let me get a clarification. In the first half of your talk, when you said it's sufficient to assume these projective simulable POVMs and then this additivity of the function on them to get generalized Gleason theorem, I presumed you meant, and therefore we know now how to assign probabilities not just to the projective simulable measurements, but to all measurements.
Yeah.
And those other measurements can be written, you know, in terms of collections of effects, but they need not themselves be projective simulable. So you've gone outside the set of projective simulable.
We've gone outside the set of measurements, but not outside the set of effects. Because
but it's
every
the same spirit in a way. I'm just saying
yeah.
It's the same thing, but for effects. Here's an effect that doesn't appear in my original set on which I make the assumptions. But I can know what value to assign to it because I can write it as a linear combination of things that I do that are.
Yeah, so then you're assigning a meaning to that effect that you haven't said in your initial assumptions, right? So your initial assumptions were just that this certain subset has these measurements,
yeah.
And then there's an extra assumption there that this thing outside is, also has some meaning which relates to these measurements that are inside.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's the difference between what we're saying, yeah. So that's fine. That's something that you can do, but that's something that we don't do here. So here, if we start with a measurement set, then we only assume that the effects that feature in those measurement sets, those are the only effects that mean anything.
Yeah, and that assumption, for instance, could be well motivated. So if you take the original Gleason's theorem, you've just proven it literally for these like projectors. And then you say, okay, let's see what happens when I do like mixtures of these two. And you find out, oh, look, what happens when I take a mixture is just lambda p plus lambda
mm-hmm.
p2.
Mm-hmm.
You say, okay, so this convex combination corresponds to, then that's, yeah, so you can kind of derive it for everything, right? Because you have,
mm-hmm.
so then you do the coarse gratings and you get the full set of effects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
I would have said the same, that I would have said the original Gleason's theorem is powerful enough to constrain how I must assign probabilities to POVMs. Why? Because every effect can be written as a linear combination of projectors, in particular a convex combination of projectors. Gleason's theorem can, you know, make some assumptions about how I am to represent projectors. But the very starting assumption that, you know, this is the space of measurements, they're described by effects, and here are how they're related to one another mathematically. This is the sum of those. That's kind of a given. We're not questioning that. And so maybe I'm wrong, but
yeah. So that's the thing that we are questioning. Like we're removing some of those assumptions, so we don't assume that any sequence of effects that sum to the identity is a measurement. So that's this assumption that we're taking out. So now only the sequences which are a projective simulable sequence are considered as a measurement.
So I agree, and I wouldn't say I'm assuming that either. I'm rather saying that, you know, I've got three measurements here. The first outcome of this measurement can be written as an operator, which is alpha times the operator that represents the first outcome of this measurement, plus beta times the operator that represents the first outcome of this measurement.
Yeah, so that, yeah, you are putting, yeah, so you can put that in as an assumption, but that's something that we don't do. So then, yeah, so with that assumption, you would say that the probability that's assigned to alpha pi 1 plus beta pi 2 would be alpha times the probability that's assigned
yeah.
to pi 1, yeah, but so we don't put that assumption in. But you could,
okay.
Like, legitimately, yeah.
And, yeah. Also, just because you've proven Gleason's theorem for a kind of subset of the quantum measurements doesn't mean you should allow it for all measurements in a sense. If you just allow it, for instance, for, like, the Pauli operators, you could also have a theory consistent with that because you have density operators. You have operators which are positive on these which aren't density operators.
Mm-hmm.
So then you could use Gleason's theorem on just a subset of the quantum measurements to get a state space which is bigger than the quantum state space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then why does it just mean that you're allowed to have extra operators, for instance?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So you can't just. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which
yeah.
I think yeah for me is more to do just about the form, and then all these issues are more to do with no restriction.
Yeah, yeah.
Chris, you did mention that you were looking at assumption defining projectives.
Yeah, yeah. I tried to mention that, but maybe not that well.
kind of question I'm wondering, John and David, about my way in. You guys gave the Chapman talk about assuming a mathematical structure for effects. There's, if I have this effect and I have this effect, then logically I could imagine sort of learning this outcome with some probability, or learning this outcome and see how
it's. What was the last thing, sorry?
Learning that it's this effect with some probability versus learning the other effect with some probability. And so at a logical level that you can imagine combinations of effects, even if you can't implement that in the lab. But there's still sort of a logical notion of uncertainty about the effects. And if you're trying to describe a theory of knowledge over such states of uncertainty,
mm-hmm.
Maybe you don't want to call them effects, fine. But because logic is has conjunctive theorems, you recover this sort of structure for these effects, which maybe you can't implement, but they're just about your states of knowledge. At the end of the day, the Gleason's theorem is about representing your knowledge about
mm-hmm.
Things. It doesn't say this is the representation, it's that I can describe the outcomes of all measurements with a
information mm-hmm.
if I so want. So it seems like considering these sort of logical extensions of the effects should be allowed.
So you're saying if you have effects corresponding to these events, then you should be able to consider combinations of those.
That's right.
Yeah. So that is an assumption that you could put in, which would probably be quite a strong assumption, I guess, mathematically. You'd probably maybe quite easily get out what we want to get out from that. So I guess the point of what we're trying to do is make the weakest assumptions possible, yeah.
Yeah, because would that be equivalent to saying I allow all convex combinations and all coarse gratings? In which case you'd very quickly get to linearity via the unique like extension of complex linear functions for linear ones.
This you're suggesting making the existence of this system an axiom. Maybe this sort of discussion sort of would motivate or not motivate that as an axiom.
Yeah, so if you're allowing yourself these axioms, but there's sort of a trade-off, right? So I think that's what I'm trying to say here. So in the assumptions of your GPT framework, you have this, you say that there's a countable set of fiducial measurement outcomes, right? And this is what gives you the convex state space. But I would say that in quantum theory, you don't. So if you kind of derive it in the Gleason way, you don't actually put this assumption in. It comes out as a consequence. So then you've got like a value judgment as to whether you want to put in the fiducial measurement outcomes as your assumption or put in that, you know, all the possible states exist in your theory. All the possible things that you would want to think of as states are states in your theory. So this is like a choice that you can make. This was an answer for the GPT framework thing, but I think it still works for quantum theory, right? So, yeah, you assume your quantum effect space, and then assume the states are like additive maps on that. That works for the GPTs and the.
When you say additive map, you mean it preserves convex sum, is that what you mean?
No.
So what does additive map mean?
It means that.
It doesn't have scalar products, is that?
It just means like, yeah. F of E1 plus E2 to F of E1 plus F of E2. Additive. Oh, can you not see? Oh, sorry. Just additivity, basically.
So you're leaving out scalar multiplication.
Yeah. Which is the difference, right, between assuming linearity and assuming additivity.
P1E1 plus P2E2 plus P4E4
Yeah, so like an affine map instead of a... Yeah.
One, let me call that. That I'll call coarse graining. The other one I'll call convex mixing. So, so you know, these are two candidate starting assumptions, and you could even think of them as potential axioms for how you want to figure out. So the point is that you can think of those in one of two different ways. You could say this is a substantive restriction on the kind of physical possibilities. So you could say, I'm imagining a world where, you know, there are measurement devices where you just can't post-process the outcome in a way that coarse grains two of them together. Those sorts of post-conditional post-processings are just, you can't build those devices. Or, you know, this is a world where you can't flip coins that would, you know, allow you to then control whether the preparation is this or this, and therefore implement the mixture. So you can conceive of them as constraints on, you know, what's physically possible. Mm-hmm. But you could also just conceive of them as constraints on the formalism you use to describe
students'
limited knowledge. So I could think, look at that equation and say, this has nothing to do with the any kind of physical post-processing. Rather, the thing on the left represents what probability I should assign to the logical proposition either outcome one occurred or outcome two occurred. And the two terms on the right are the probabilities I assign to the propositions outcome one occurred and the proposition outcome two occurred. If I believe in the rules of classical probability theory, then I have no choice. I have to abide by that equation because probability theory dictates what the probability of a disjunction of mutually exclusive propositions will be.
Yeah, so that's why I'm favoring this.
Right. So on those lines, note that if you'd written down the formula with the convex mixtures, I can give exactly the same argument that I can think of that convex mixture as not the result of the outcome of coin flip and then condition, but just I happen to be ignorant and I quantify my ignorance by these relative probabilities. Question, what probability should I assign to this versus that? And so that is why I think it actually really doesn't matter where you start in Gleason's theorem with that or with the other. They're really equivalent. They're both assuming the formalism of classical probability theory.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in the way I've laid it out, I wouldn't actually describe this as coarse graining. I would describe this as a consequence of so the probabilities having to sum to one. So if you require this for all effects, then you get that out as a consequence. So this doesn't actually require any coarse graining, right?
But I think I can interpret that equation in two ways as well. Like,
you could,
Well, I don't know. I mean, the way I'd like to interpret it is, if I have a logical disjunction of a set of mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive propositions, the probability I assign to that disjunction has to be one.
Yeah.
One of those things has to be true.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would just as well take the first one because they both follow the
probability theory. Yeah, true.
Mutually exclusive there is a fallback, though, because once you start talking about mutually exclusive, then you're in your Baum predictors, and that's the original Gleason theorem, not the one over the others.
Sure. Yeah, no, you're right. I guess I was implicitly thinking of projectors here.
You're exhausted the knowledge.
Well, I mean, I think the E1 and E2, even though they're effects, could still represent mutually exclusive propositions, namely outcome one occurred and outcome two occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And those can't both be true. That's the sense in which they're mutually exclusive.
Thank you again.